This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Phineas Gage was a railroad construction worker in the 1800s, and one day on the job he suffered a tremendous accident. An iron rod was driven through his head. He survived, but much of his brain's left frontal lobe was destroyed, and many people say this profoundly changed his personality. His case is now remembered as the American Crowbar Case and has become a legend in neuroscience and psychology. Phineas Gage taught us that damage to parts of the brain may alter the structure of the mind. My guest today has spent her career investigating the psychological and metaphysical significance of brain damage. Elizabeth Schechter is a professor of philosophy at Washington University in St. Louis. She spent much of the year in Durham as a fellow at the National Humanities Center. She's giving a talk at the center tonight about her research on split-brain surgeries, and she joins us now to talk more about it. Lizzie, welcome to State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thanks so much, Frank.
So tell us, first of all, what is split-brain surgery?
Okay, great. Split-brain surgery is the colloquial term for surgery that sections or cuts through the corpus callosum, which is the largest fiber tract in the human brain and which connects the two cerebral hemispheres, the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere. And this is performed as a treatment for severe cases of epilepsy that haven't responded to non-surgical intervention. But the philosophical significance of the split-brain cases is always it lies not in the surgeries themselves or in the medical condition that prompts the surgeries, but in the long-term consequences of these surgeries.
So it's been a long time since I was in a biology class. Back then, what I was taught was that this corpus callosum, this connector between right and left hemispheres, was a kind of a communication network. That communication between the hemispheres took place over this network of cells.
Yes. And that still appears to be true, although, I mean, it's not totally clear yet, but it appears as though one of the ways it allows information to be integrated across the brain is by creating a synchronized neural activity across the brain, giving rise to a kind of unified set of neural activity.
So this should be a tantalizing clue. If we say left hemisphere, right hemisphere, mm-hmm. there's something in between that goes between.
Mm-hmm.
Something about the fact, and we do know this, that they have that left and right hemispheres certainly serve different functions for us, right?
Yes, they serve somewhat different functions. They receive perceptual information that overlapping, but somewhat distinct perceptual information, and they have somewhat distinct motor control. And yes, there's some differences in their cognitive processing as well.
All right, so can you walk us through an example of what the behavioral studies on split brains can tell us now?
Sure, yeah. So the standard line has always been that after the initial recovery period, split-brain subjects in their day-to-day lives don't behave in a particularly remarkable fashion, at least most of the time. But under carefully controlled experimental conditions, their behavior does, in fact, become somewhat remarkable. So under the controls characteristic of the split-brain experiment, perceptual information is carefully directed to only a single hemisphere at a time to the extent possible. This is probably easiest to understand in the case of tactile sensation. So imagine, closing your eyes and just feeling some objects around you with your hands. Each hand sends touch information about the objects directly to the opposite hemisphere. So the right hand to the left hemisphere and the left hand to the right hemisphere. Of course, your two hemispheres are presumably connected by a corpus callosum, allowing either hemisphere to gain access to the information that only a single hemisphere initially received. But in the split-brain subject, in whom the corpus callosum is missing, this information more or less stays put. So imagine blindfolding a split-brain subject so that he can't see his hands. And now put an object, say like a pen, in first his right hand. You ask him what he's holding, he feels the pen, he says it's a pen. Now you put an object, say a pipe, in the subject's left hand, and you ask him what he's holding, and he'll say he doesn't know. This is because touch information about the pipe has been sent directly to his right hemisphere, and in the large majority of the population, the right hemisphere is mute. It lacks a capacity for spoken language. But if you now ask him to reach into a box of objects while still blindfolded, using the same left hand, which is primarily controlled by the right hemisphere, and select the object he was holding a moment ago, he easily selects the pipe. If you give him a sheet of paper and a pencil to hold in his left hand, he can draw you a picture of a pipe. He may even write the word pipe. He just can't speak it. There's a similar story to be told in the visual realm. So right now you are looking at my face, for instance, mm-hmm. but you also have peripheral vision. So everything to the right of what you're focused on goes to your left hemisphere, to the left of what you're focused on goes to the right hemisphere. So in one experiment, a split-brain subject is staring at a point on a screen. There's two symbols are projected, one to the left, one to the right of the point. So it was like a question mark on the left, a dollar sign on the right. You ask the subject what he saw. He says, using his left hemisphere, that he saw a dollar sign. He doesn't mention the question mark. Now, again, you give him pencil, sheet of paper to hold in his left hand while he's blindfolded, ask him to draw what he saw. He, using his right hemisphere, draws the question mark that was on the left. And if you don't let him look at what he drew and you ask him to say what he just drew, again, using his left hemisphere, he'll say, well, I drew the dollar sign. Now, when you let him open his eyes and look at what he drew and you ask him, he'll say, using his left hemisphere, I drew a question mark. But if you ask him why, he says, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. And this really suggests that what we do so that the data is perceived differently in different hemispheres, it's perhaps stored differently, mm-hmm. And that what we do kind of in our day-to-day, if as long as we're well, you know, our corpus callosum is intact, is sum it. We make a sum and we come up with a kind of a single answer. Same with our vision. You cover one eye, cover things look different through one eye, but we sum the whole thing and say, mm-hmm. And get it all together. And so it's this inability to sum that creates the difference, but then it raises the question, well, wait a minute, what is that thing that is summed together if the data is in separate places? Does that raise a question about what is that other thing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's always been very tempting to characterize the split brain results in terms like the following. So in the example I just described with the question mark and the dollar sign, it's really tempting to say, okay, well, the left hemisphere saw a dollar sign and said dollar sign. The right hemisphere saw a question mark and drew a question mark, but the left hemisphere doesn't know that that's what the right hemisphere saw. But this way of characterizing the results is also controversial and perhaps even slightly perturbing, because it seems to suggest that it's no longer the split brain subject himself as a whole that is seeing or speaking or drawing, but then instead there are indeed two minds and two streams of consciousness within the subject, a right hemisphere mind and a left hemisphere mind.
So let's talk some more about those debates, because it raises questions about that. Who is that me that put them all together, right? I mean, all those questions. So talk about some of the psychological and philosophical questions that this kind of surgery has raised over the years.
Yeah, so I'd say two big ones. One concerns the relationship between the mind and the brain. Actually, you were mentioning 19th century understanding of the brain. And they knew at that point that the brain was the organ of thought in some sense. So they knew that the same way if you injure someone's leg, they have trouble walking. If you injure someone's brain, they have trouble thinking or feeling or something like that. But there was debate about whether or not that meant that the mind just was the brain, or whether the mind and the brain merely causally interacted. Like maybe the brain was a kind of sophisticated remote control system for the body that the mind used. And one of the reasons, one of the arguments against the materialist minds or brains position was that we think of our minds as unitary, that each of us has one. But the brain was visibly structurally double or dual. And so anti-materialists said, aha, this shows that the mind can't be the brain. Materialists pointed to the corpus callosum, and they hypothesized that the corpus callosum didn't just physically but psychically connected the two hemispheres. And then, of course, they started debating about what would happen if you cut the corpus callosum. And the materialists predicted then you would get two minds, and the anti-materialists said, no, the mind would remain unified. And actually, at least one anti-materialist volunteered to undergo the surgery in order to prove that his mind would remain unitary. And interestingly, when the split brain studies were actually performed in the 20th century, they were just ambiguous enough for both sides to view their particular hypothesis as having been confirmed. So those who the materialists believed, aha, it turns out to be true. You divide the brain, you divide the mind. That suggests that they're one. The anti-materialists thought that there was still something that remained unified or unitary in the split brain subject. And they believed their position was confirmed. The second and related philosophically significant aspect of the split brain studies is, as you said, it just raises this question of what are we? Are these subjects indeed, do they indeed have two minds? Are they indeed two persons? And if so, what does that say about us? Could science someday reveal under carefully controlled experimental situations that we also have two minds?
And it does, I guess, lead to questions about where is this thing called personality, my sense of self? How does that thing get constructed? You know,
where
is that? So tell us about your research then and how you investigate these questions.
Yeah, so the book I'm working on argues that self-consciousness is really key to the split brain puzzle, which is interesting because it hasn't been addressed that much. So lots of things have minds but aren't persons, self-conscious agents with rights and responsibilities. You know, when a two-year-old hits someone, we don't charge them with assault. We don't view two-year-olds as responsible for their actions in the way that you and I are. And one of the essential characteristics of persons is self-consciousness. I think that the split brain phenomenon has been hard to resolve because people have sensed that if there are two self-conscious minds in the split brain subject, this suggests that there are two persons. But no one really treats the subjects like two persons. They sign one consent form when they're participating in experiments, for instance. They aren't asked twice what they want for lunch, just once. They don't get two votes. They're treated as if they're a single self-conscious moral agent. And I argue in the book that that's because although the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere, I argue, do indeed have distinct minds and have the intrinsic capacity for self-consciousness, self-consciousness operates in them more the way it does in you or in me than the way it operates within, say, a pair of conjoined twins, like Brittany and Abigail Hansel, the sisters with their own reality TV show who share a single body. Their self-consciousness is used to Brittany's self-consciousness distinguishes her from Abigail. She refers to Abigail using the second person. She thinks of herself as one of a pair of sisters. In the split brain case, although you have these two minds who seem to think self-conscious thoughts, neither of them recognizes the existence of the other. So either treats what either itself or the other has done as something it itself has done. Both hemispheres, in other words, also assume that the split brain human being is a single person, and both of them think, I am that person.
Well, so let's look at this from a different point of view now. The same question, you talked about conjoined twins. We talk about what happens in one brain where you split the corpus callosum. What about multiple personality disorder or dissociative disorders wherein an individual takes on an entirely different persona?
I do address, actually, dissociative identity disorder in the book, too, and it's a little complicated because there are so many controversies surrounding the disorder, and it's not clear that there's a single kind of thing going on there. But my research has led me to believe that, at least in some cases, there are subjects with dissociative identity disorder who do believe on some level or whose alters or different personality states believe. Again, there's no sort of uncontroversial way of characterizing these cases, but do believe that there are multiple persons within the DID subject. And that does, in fact, allow these different alters or personality states to sustain somewhat different social relationships with other parties, for instance. There are cases in which other parties view themselves as, for instance, the romantic partners of only some of the alters in question. And I do think that what allows that is fundamentally this, what I call mutual recognition, the fact that these different alters or personality states within the DID subject do recognize each other, believe that each other, you know, that they are and relate to each other as distinct persons.
So does this mean that some of the research, it seems to me, then would have to focus on how it is we construct our identity to begin with? What is it that makes us, you know, we wake up in the morning out of a dream state where we have been entirely differently and completely believed the most preposterous set of circumstances. That reality was real while we were asleep. We wake up, we reboot. I remember who I am and where I'm supposed to go today. Yep. And that persona just kind of, you know, once the screen lights up, there I am.
Yep. And I think, I mean, clearly there are all kinds of what we would call hardwired aspects to this that are just sort of pre-given to you by virtue of your, physical architecture, nervous system architecture, and even the architecture of the body. But there's also, there is cultural variation. And if you think about kids, for instance, children often, let's say a kid spills something and you tell them to clean it up, they'll often respond, but I didn't mean to, it was an accident. We have to be taught to some extent that you know, we're responsible for everything we do, even if we don't know why we did something, or even if we feel that, you know, it wasn't our best self that did it. And I think certainly split brain subjects are subject to those same kinds of social pressures and expectations. And that's part of what explains the lack of mutual recognition between right and left hemisphere.
Your last chapter plays with the notion of plural individualism. What do you mean?
That's right. So I talk about the so since I argue in the book that right and left hemisphere have this intrinsic capacity for self-consciousness, but fail to recognize each other as distinct self-conscious beings. And I believe that this is partly because they're not encouraged to recognize each other as distinct self-conscious beings by experimenters who, for instance, again, just ask the subjects to sign a single consent form and so on. This raises the question of whether neuropsychologists are then acting in error, or whether righty and lefty, as I call them, should be encouraged to recognize each other as distinct self-conscious beings. So in this last somewhat playful chapter, I talk about the possibility of plural personhood. Could we come to socially recognize single human beings as indeed containing or constituting multiple persons who would perhaps have different social relationships? They might be married to different people. They might have different jobs, again, potentially different voting rights and so on. And so in that chapter, I talk about some of the challenges to plural individualism. But I do conclude that it might be possible.
You know, you realize this is the end stage of the logic of the current political idea of pathological, I call it pathological individualism, a kind of individualism that doesn't recognize our communal evolution. But it is kind of the logical extension of individualism as taught, right? It's like, well, yeah, then everything we think becomes a separate self with a different vote, right?
Let's all vote. Yeah, absolutely. Although the more I've thought about it, the grayer the areas get. So for instance, what's the difference between plural individualism and collectivism? It would depend on how it played out. But suppose we did come to accept that a single human being contained or constituted multiple persons, and yet we decided that, you know, for moral and legal reasons, it would be best to hold all those persons jointly responsible for any of their actions. Well, now that would start to look like the collectivist position, that indeed it can be social groups and not just individual human beings who are the proper units of responsibilities and
powers
and rights.
Now, at the end of our conversation, we come to the deepest mystical questions raised by your work, which is the sort of the collective all one and the particle individual. But so rather than begin that conversation here, are there theological implications in your work, do you think?
Yes. Well, interestingly, certainly some theologians have thought so. Although, again, interestingly, some of them have looked at the cases and thought that there is indeed something that remains unitary in the subjects, this sense of self, and that may be something like an immaterial spirit or soul. Others, Christian theologians, looked at these cases and took them to show that indeed we are physical, and they thought that we are fully physical beings, and they thought that was actually more in line with an earlier, more pre-Hellenistic understanding of the soul, in which indeed we live on this earth as physical, purely physical beings.
It's great stuff. Fascinating research. Wish I had more time, but great to talk with you for the time we had. Lizzie Schechter, thanks so much.
Thank you, Frank.
Lizzie Schechter is a fellow at the National Humanities Center in Durham right now. She's going to give a talk about her split brain subject research at the National Humanities Center tonight at 5 p.m. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. There's more State of Things just ahead. Stay tuned. You're listening to the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.